loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, South Carolina Congressman Mark Sanford was defeated in the Republican primary yesterday by a state legislator who criticized him for not supporting President Trump strongly enough. Trump tweeted his opposition to Sanford just hours before the polls closed yesterday, and that appears to have been enough to seal his fate. Next, Republican leaders late last night managed to pull together a long-awaited immigration agreement that satisfied both moderates and conservatives. The agreement calls for votes next week on two different immigration bills, a conservative one that will likely be defeated, and one that the Republican leadership will write this week with input from both of their factions. Then the U.S. Senate is challenging President Trump by inserting language in the annual defense bill that would prohibit him from lifting sanctions on Chinese telecom ZTE. The company had agreed to pay a $1 billion fine and to allow American inspectors in after it was caught selling prohibited items to Iran and North Korea. And then in a victory for Amazon, Starbucks, and other major corporations, the Seattle City Council voted to repeal a tax that was meant to fund efforts to combat Seattle's homeless problem. The tax would have raised $47 million a year to fund affordable housing projects. And finally, in a major defeat for the Justice Department, a federal judge yesterday approved AT&T's $85.4 billion merger with Time Warner. It's a decision that is expected to unleash a wave of corporate mergers beginning with CVS and Aetna Insurance. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first we turn to South Carolina. South Carolina Congressman Mark Sanford was defeated in the Republican primary yesterday by a state legislator who criticized him for not supporting President Trump strongly enough. Trump tweeted his opposition to Sanford just hours before the polls closed yesterday, and that appears to have been enough to seal his fate. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Ted, good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Ted, I think a lot of political observers in the country have always thought that Mark Sanford had nine lives. This is a guy who had been a congressman, then he was a two-term governor of South Carolina. And then one day, after telling the press that he was going to hike the Appalachian Trail, a reporter saw him in Atlanta Airport with his passport coming back from Buenos Aires, Argentina. And as it turned out, Sanford had not gone on the Appalachian Trail. He had been cheating on his wife with his Argentinian girlfriend. So things fell apart. Well, lo and behold, a year later, he makes a political comeback. He runs for Congress. He wins. And he's been winning by huge margins ever since. This was 2010. Just winning by huge margins. Well, yesterday he lost. And in the Republican primary, he could only muster 46% of the vote. What do you make of this? This says, I think, more about South Carolina than it does about Mark Sanford.
I think it does. I think it also says a lot about voter redistricting. There's congressional redistricting. Sanford noted himself that his district is, I believe the word he used was schizophrenic, but I might be mistaken about that. But essentially, not a contiguous district demographically, in that it contained one major city and then a lot of which leans Democratic, and then one, and then a lot of very rural, very pro-Trump, traditionally what we would think of as southern, you know, southern, typical southern demographic, very rural and farmers and so on. So it seems like the delineation of the district is in the end what ultimately got him. I think it also says a lot about the strength of Donald Trump in the Republican base. I mean, it's not really about numbers. Trump has always, his support has been consistently between 35 and 40% of the public, which isn't that great, really. But the enthusiasm of that 35 or 40% is extremely deep. You know, it's kind of the opposite of, say, think of a George H.W. Bush, who was popular enough, but the support was never very deep. It was wider, but shallower. In this case, Donald Trump is able, I mean, I don't think his tweet made the difference, but I think there was a combination of a perfect storm there. I think also people finally started to focus on, all these years later, that happens too, where people start to focus on something that annoyed them about a candidate, and they decide to take it out on them later. So I think the Appalachian Trail thing, the attack ads that reminded people of that, there's just a lot of things came together and created a perfect storm for him.
There's a lot of talk about potential primary challengers to Donald Trump in the 2020 election when he presumably will be running for re-election. You know, Mitt Romney is going to, it seems, you know, inevitably return to the Senate. Do you think that the defeat of Mark Sanford in this primary is going to give pause to those people, that it sort of demonstrates the enduring strength of Donald Trump, at least among the people who vote in Republican Party primaries?
Well, I think if you're a Republican, you've gotten that memo at this point. There's no way someone like Romney isn't well aware of Trump's strength within the GOP. And in fact, Romney had been thought, for example, to want to return to go to Utah, essentially become a carpetbagger, except for just, I guess, sort of a weird, there's just the religious aspect of him being a Mormon, of course, going to Utah, but he's not from Utah. He's not of Utah. But everyone thought he was just doing this kind of the way Hillary Clinton did when she moved to New York to run for Senate. And they thought that he was setting himself up for a 2020 presidential run. I thought that myself. And then just last week, Trump, I think Romney pretty much kind of with it ruled out the idea of running for president just by saying that he thought that Trump would win. And so I think he's not going to. I don't think Romney's in 2020. I think they have the memo. They know that it's Trump's Republican Party now.
I think that's right. And, you know, despite the fact that we're seeing seats flipping around the country from Republican to Democrat, that's not what this is about. This is about a fight inside the Republican Party. And there are wide swaths of America where Donald Trump is immensely popular. And inside the party, I think a lot of potential politicians or politicians already elected are expected to toe the line or face the consequences. And that's what happened in South Carolina last night. Mark Sanford has been outspoken in his opposition to Donald Trump and paid the price.
He did. Trump definitely had it out for him. He had it out. It was not a mutual admiration society. And Trump, I think it's true that all you really had to do was remind these rural South Carolina voters that Mark Sanford had criticized Donald Trump. And even Sanford found himself in the kind of silly position, despite being able to take credit for having had courage to fight against the standard bearer of his own party, of having to say that, well, I did agree with the president more often than not, so that should count for something, okay? Well, I mean, it didn't count for enough.
Donald Trump tweeted, you know, following the results of the election, my political representatives didn't want me to get involved in the Mark Sanford primary, thinking that Sanford would easily win, but blah, 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 I had to give it a shot. Whether or not it's true that, you know, Trump's advisors were all clamoring, you know, don't get involved, don't get involved. I mean, maybe this will at least send an affirmative sign to him that, you know, when Trump intervenes in Republican Party primaries, he's usually successful. And so will this potentially presage, you know, even greater intervention in the future, you know, directly from Donald Trump himself acting basically as an individual?
You know, I think the idea that there's a lot of people, even though he has a lot of followers, I think the idea that Trump sending a tweet is causing voters to say, oh, well, now that Trump says I should vote against Mark Sanford and for Kate Arrington, I should do that. I think that's a little silly. I think it's more just the overall optics of these attack ads where Sanford's opponent was able to credibly say, and Sanford was not able to credibly counter, and Trump supported the narrative that Sanford had criticized Trump. And for many people, that was enough. Although I don't think it's determinative in all cases, I think it switched enough votes and obviously led to kind of a surprising outcome considering Sanford's previous popularity.
There are other primary challengers across the country running in Republican primaries. Do you expect this to be the start of a pattern, or is this going to go district by district?
I think these things always go district by district, and this midterm election does not appear to be nationalized like 1994 with Newt Gingrich's contract with America. But it's at the same time, Trump has an outsized presence within his party more so than, for example, Obama did in 2014 or 2010. And so Trump's a factor. He's a bigger factor than you would think, but obviously he's not going to be the only one. The question is he determinant? Is he the biggest? Is he a plurality factor? I think we're just going to have to watch and see.
There was a story on Politico a couple of days ago about how Barack Obama has been holding meetings, one-on-one meetings with several possible Democratic 2020 contenders. And, you know, according to this story, we can't, you know, vouch for its authenticity, but it seems to be, you know, pretty well researched. He was urging people, you know, focus on kitchen table issues about, you know, the practical things that affect people's day-to-day lives. When we're talking about the midterm election and, you know, who will ultimately come out on top and who will be, you know, the leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties. I mean, if the Democrats are going to win and they follow Obama's advice, or will they follow Obama's advice, I guess is the question that I'm getting at. Will the Republicans who come out of this primary process have to face a Democratic Party with a real cogent message like that one?
Well, I think it would have been awesome if Obama had followed Obama's advice, but that's a separate issue. It's good advice. Bernie could give the same advice. I don't know if I think the Democratic Party is still very much in thrall to the identity politics mode that kind of peaked with Hillary Clinton's campaign. I'm with her kind of mode, and so things could pivot, but we haven't, you know, I've been around a long time. I haven't seen the Democratic Party pivot in my lifetime. And they certainly haven't pivoted to the left.
And when they try, they're not good at it, frankly. Ted, we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Republican leaders late last night managed to pull together a long-awaited immigration agreement that satisfied both moderates and conservatives. The agreement calls for votes next week on two different immigration bills, a conservative one that will likely be defeated, and one that the Republican leadership will write this week with input from both of their factions. We're joined from Philadelphia by Miguel Andrade. He is the communications manager at the immigrant rights advocacy organization Juntos, and he's also a member of the board of directors of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Miguel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Miguel, I can't help but to think that the Republican leadership really has not succeeded so far in herding cats on this issue. There's been a fight between the moderate faction and the conservative faction for the last several weeks. There's no agreement in sight on Dreamers. Nobody has even consulted the Democrats, and the Senate hasn't said that they're going to move on any of this stuff. How do you think this is going to work out in the coming week?
I mean, I really do think we're sort of seeing a stalemate play out when it comes to the DACA issue. I personally am not very optimistic about something potentially happening with DACA, but I do think that it's very vital for everybody that is in support of this sort of vital program to be actively involved with their congresspeople, with their senators, with the representatives, and actively involved because it is something that benefits so many young people in this country. I don't see them sort of, at least at the federal level, I don't see them really moving forward on this issue. We're sort of spinning our wheels hearing the same conversations over and over again, and I think it's sort of like they're playing the a long waiting game with this and sort of like running the clock out, it feels.
I have to agree. It's as though there's so much of nothing that it's not even newsworthy. I mean, the only thing that's really newsworthy, I think, is the fact that they cannot come to some sort of an agreement.
Which is that really newsworthy?
Yeah, exactly. And is that even really newsworthy? There's a group of Republicans along the border that has allied itself with the moderate faction. But, you know, Paul Ryan changed the rules when he became Speaker of the House, that instead of bills going through the Rules Committee and then being sent to the floor for a vote, all bills have to go through the Speaker's office. And so if the Speaker doesn't like a bill, it doesn't see the light of day. The problem is, for the Republicans, that there are so many members of their caucus who want some sort of a vote on this issue, whether it's the moderate version or the conservative version, that they're willing to try to have one or both of these measures discharged from committee. Now, that's a very rare process. What it is you have to have, I think it's 2/3 of the caucus sign a discharge petition. And what that does is it forces a bill out of committee to the floor for a vote without the support of the speaker. Very, very rare. But again, as Miguel just said, even if it goes to the floor, even if it passes, which it probably won't, the Senate hasn't said that it's going to do anything on this bill or any other immigration bill.
Yeah, Miguel, you know, the arrangement that Paul Ryan worked out, this compromise where the House will consider two different bills in exchange, you know, this effort for a discharge petition, you know, to sort of go around the Republican leadership of the House and force a vote on just sort of a clean renewal of DACA. That compromise was the consequence of extreme intransigence by, you know, the far right faction of the Republican Party that calls itself, in the House of Representatives, at least, the Freedom Caucus. It's remarkable how a group of far right extremists, I think you could call them, are able to sort of hold up this whole process.
I mean, absolutely. And I think it kind of stems from the leadership that is within the executive branch of government right now, with President Trump being in there. I feel like it has emboldened a lot of these sort of, and I think you're right in calling them right-wing extremists. It just so happens that they have elected positions within the U.S. government. I think they just feel like they can sort of do whatever it is that they want without any sort of, you know, repercussions or consequences, or even like having to interact with other people. It's the sense that I get a little bit, it's sort of like my way or the highway when it comes to a lot of, especially around immigration issues right now with the Republican Party. I think the big thing to remember, though, is that we just need, I think, really emphasizing the fact that like a clean renewal and reenactment of DACA is the absolute best thing that could happen. And by clean, that means absolutely no border enforcement, no further criminalization, no further funding towards ICE for border patrol, because we're already seeing what these agencies and what these systems are doing with the current funding that they have. We do not need to give these agencies that are violating people's human rights left and right even more funding.
Miguel, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. You know, there was so much talk of a DACA bill, and even talk of a clean DACA bill, at least on the Senate side, over the last, let's say, couple of months. And then it sort of died away. Do you see any chance of DACA passing either one of the two houses of Congress in this session?
Passing it potentially, but I think the question is that it will be a clean version or not. I think that's the biggest sort of holdup that has been happening. And I know it's a little bit of a divisive topic, even within the immigrant rights movement, because on one hand, you do have, you know, a lot of what I've seen personally on the ground, from the work on the ground, we hear a lot of actual parents saying, it doesn't matter if I can't have something as long as my children have it. But then we have a lot of, you know, very vocal Dreamers or in DACA recipients who have been saying, we don't want anything that will benefit us at the cost of, you know, potentially further criminalizing our parents. So that is the conversation that is happening within the immigrant rights movement. I do think that a version of DACA could potentially move forward either in the House or the Senate. I think the biggest question is what else is going to be tagged onto it.
So then where does the movement go from here? You know, clearly there's deadlock, like we've been talking about, in Congress. There's a White House that's extremely hostile to any type of progressive move when it comes to immigration reform and immigrant rights. But there is a similar deadlock, I think, during the first term of the Obama administration. And, you know, the DACA program itself was the consequence, I think, of the sit-ins that were conducted by young immigrant rights activists, undocumented people themselves, at primarily Democratic Party politicians' offices, you know, in the run-up to the election, to put the pressure on the Democratic Party itself and force some kind of action to be taken. I mean, where can the grassroots movement go now? What options are available?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very important to highlight that DACA was not something that the Obama administration sort of just woke up one day and decided to give. It was a result of direct action and organizing, led primarily by young undocumented young people. So thank you so much for raising that. I think right now we're at a time at the federal level where the immigrant rights movement, we should definitely not lose focus going and rallying and protesting and doing sittings at the federal level with like the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, holding both parties accountable. But I think this is also a key moment for the immigrant rights movement to really look towards organizing and policy work at the local level. Specifically here in Philadelphia, we just saw like the victory of Philadelphia against the Department of Justice over our sanctuary city policy. That is something that is happening at the local level, and something that local municipalities have the right to pass policies that can protect their immigrant communities. So while we're seeing sort of these attacks coming at the federal level, there's a lot that local municipalities can do. And I think it is the duty of the immigrant rights movement to sort of have a two-pronged approach of going at the national level, but really holding local elected officials accountable to protect their communities.
And Miguel, your organization, Juntos, is doing some of that in Philadelphia, right? Talk about those efforts, and particularly this community resistance zone project that's going on.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we have enacted in the last couple of months, since November of last year, actually, is sort of building resistance zones within certain areas of different communities. Started here in Philadelphia, we actually just did a couple of trainings in Pittsburgh. We'll be doing one in Harrisburg in 2 weeks, sort of spreading the concept and model to different parts of the state. But essentially, is building zones and areas within our communities where, one, people are being trained, and not just immigrant members, but also just communities in general, neighborhoods as a whole, being trained on what their rights are with immigration and police, because we need to understand the connection between the criminal and immigration system in this country, and also training people on how they can support each other in cases of abuse by both immigration and police. So it's teaching community members who are affected what their rights are and making sure everybody's in knows what to do in those situations, and then training potential allies or people who want to support these communities, what it is that they can do to support each other. So it could be filming cases of abuse, filming or taking photos of a raid or a stop, or even just like watching to make sure that people's rights aren't being abused while these agencies going into our communities.
Yeah, I think that's so important, because almost every big city in the country has some type of quote-unquote sanctuary policy, right, where the politicians who run the city can go in front of people and say, oh, no, we're resisting. We're not just going along with the administration's policies. But really, that's not enough. Just in the last 30 seconds, I mean, people themselves have to take matters into their own hands.
Absolutely. And one of the big things that we've been saying locally at the local level here in Philadelphia is that even though we just want our sanctuary city status, there's way more things that the city could do to expand its definition of sanctuary. And locally for us, the big thing that we're seeing is the information sharing of databases, of local city databases, which happens a lot across the country with immigration agents. So that's one of the things that a lot of local municipalities should keep an eye out for and do the research within their local areas to see if this is a possibility, a possible move that their local officials can do to expand sanctuary in their localities.
Terrific. We will leave it right there. We were joined from Philadelphia by Miguel Andrade. Miguel is the communications manager at the immigrant rights advocacy organization Juntos, and he's also a member of the board of directors of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I am Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
The U.S. Senate is challenging President Trump by inserting language in the annual defense bill that would prohibit him from lifting sanctions on Chinese telecom ZTE. The company had agreed to pay a $1 billion fine and to allow American inspectors after it was caught selling prohibited items to Iran and North Korea. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Dr. Rasmus is also the author of the article in the World Review of Political Economy entitled Trump's Deja Vu China Trade War. Dr. Rasmus, welcome back.
My pleasure.
So there seems to be something of a direct challenge between, or I should say, by Republicans in the Senate and the White House. What we have is Donald Trump making nice with the Chinese and saying that he is going to suspend or to lift the $1 billion fine and the provision that ZTE must allow American inspectors into the company. And the Senate said, not so fast. There's one senator in particular, Bob Corker. He's the Republican from Tennessee. He's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who said that that Donald Trump is just plain wrong on this, and he's attached this amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act. Where do you think this goes from here?
Well, you know, you got to understand that this resistance in the Senate to the ZTE deal is linked to the current Trump-China trade negotiations. There were three elements split here in the U.S. trade approach to China. The bankers want more access to China markets, and China is giving it to them. They're dangling it out there. Also, Trump wants China to purchase more U.S. goods. And China's indicated they'll buy more farm goods. But the odd man out seems to be the concern about China technology transfer that the Pentagon intelligence agencies are most concerned about. That group seems to be, on the low end of the three-part objectives for the U.S. with China trade. There's some indication that the intelligence and military sectors of the U.S. economy are working through the Senate here to reestablish their goal here, because ZTE, you see, is purchasing U.S. Goods and companies are trying to, and this concern that ZTE is a Chinese company that's trying to exploit technology transfer from the U.S., 5G, which is one of the three next-gen technology futures here, the other being cybersecurity and artificial intelligence. The military is very concerned about that. So they're trying to reassert themselves through Congress, the way I read this. Corker, of course, is not a friend of Trump. They've been feuding, and so is Rubio, who's smarting over the last election. So those forces have joined together, undoubtedly with pressure from the defense intelligence community to try to stop the ZTE deal here that Trump has worked out. Which would allow ZTE to continue purchases in the U.S. from U.S. companies. So I see this tied in with this technology issue in China trade, and of course personalities involved, Corker, Rubio versus Trump.
There's one part of the political economic equation that I've been trying to figure out, and I can't quite wrap my head around. I mean, Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, and maybe the de facto leader of the Democratic Party itself, has been absolutely relentless when it comes to ZTE, again, being to the right of Donald Trump on most foreign policy issues. He's been, urging over and over again and trying to develop a public pressure campaign to make sure that the sanctions on ZTE are reinstated, and before that, to make sure that they remained. A major part of the Democratic Party's political base, I mean, their true political base, are the big telecommunications corporations and the Silicon Valley corporations. Does that come into, basically, is there opposition because of that? Because these companies see ZTE as a competitor? Or is there, rabid support for the ZTE sanctions, basically in spite of their strong support from the telecommunications and Silicon Valley capitalists? Because those firms actually do sell components to ZTE. Where does it fall? You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's lobbying going on by U.S. telecom companies through the Democrats, which, as you say, they and the tech industry, Silicon Valley, have strong money relationships with the Democratic Party. They're big, big contributors. So, there's no doubt that, Schumer is blocking with Corker and Rubio here. In this particular issue, what his motivation is, it may be anything that Donald Trump does on a foreign policy level here, they may automatically just oppose it. I'm not sure. It's not clear what the Democrats' motivation is, except to paint Trump as always allying with the former enemies of American capitalism and shooting down the former allies of American capalism. That's a policy message that they're pushing. But it's not clear what their true motivation is, they meaning Schumer and the Democrats.
I wonder if there is actually no sense of immediacy in this thing, because we're not seeing real legislative infighting. What we're seeing, and I was surprised, frankly, by this, we're seeing in this White House statement that they will seek to change the language later on in the legislative process. Nowhere in this White House statement to the Wall Street Journal today did the word veto appear. And so I think that the White House is content to allow people like Rubio and Corker to make their political point. And then when people aren't paying attention anymore, they just change the language in conference committee, or they change it on the House side and then have the House change it in conference committee. And then everybody's happy. Corker and Rubio get to tell their constituents that they stood up to the president, they stood up to the Chinese. And then at the same time, the president gets what he wants.
Well, that could be certainly one of the interpretations. It may also be that, Trump is putting up a token resistance here, and he'll say to the Chinese, well, I did everything I can, but the, Congress that I can't control rebuffed me on all this. We will see when we get, as you say, into the conference committee, what final language they quietly work out that doesn't really get a lot of publicity. That will be the true telling evidence of what's really behind this. But we will see when we get there. It's all part of, as the whole trade situation is, part of a political maneuvering here. And publicity seeking before the November elections.
Let's say that the sanctions against ZTE are reinstated. Let's say that it remains in the National Defense Authorization Act and it's signed into law. That'll turn up the heat in terms of the U.S. trade war, the trade dispute with China. The United States might be able to handle that if it just had to think about China. But considering what happened at the G7 summit in Quebec last week, do you think that the United States is sort of pulled in too many different directions when it comes to trade? I mean, how is that whole blow up at the G7 going to come back to impact this other related field, which is the trade conflict with China?
Well, I think, the G7 event and everything was typical Trump strategy. You shake up your opponents, you make yourself look like you're outrageous and your demands are out in left field, well, actually right field, I guess. Then you fall back to a position of bargaining and negotiating, controlling the agenda from that point forward in negotiations. I think a lot of that is involved with Trump posturing here on trade negotiations with both the NAFTA and the Europeans. I see a deal that will be forthcoming in both of those cases, probably not until the eve of the November elections or afterwards, but they will strike a deal. I'm quite confident of that. The China thing is a bigger deal for Trump because what he can really deliver here is the sale of more U.S. goods, particularly agricultural goods, to China if he strikes a deal with them. And also he'll earn the support and the financial support of the banking industry because they will be the big beneficiaries of greater access into China markets. So there's much more to be won for Trump in the trade deal with China that's forthcoming. And I think it will be forthcoming as well because China knows the concessions and has already strongly signaled is going to buy more agricultural goods and it's going to provide more access to U.S. banking interests. So that's the deal that will be struck there. The party left out, of course, is let's stop Chinese technology transfer, i.e. the intelligence agencies and the military. They're the ones who may come out the losers in a China trade deal. So that ties in again with the ZTE thing and why they are pushing the congressional levers to try to re-inject themselves into the negotiations on the trade deal.
I wonder if this is a political strategy that we're going to begin seeing, where the president makes an accusation against a foreign company, especially a Chinese company or let's say a Russian company, and then backs off when he gets a concession, whether the concession's from Congress or the concession's from that company's government. I guess it remains to be seen. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California, and author of the book Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. He's also the author of the article in the World Review of Political Economy entitled Trump's Deja Vu, China Trade War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
In a victory for Amazon, Starbucks, and other major corporations, the Seattle City Council voted to repeal a tax that was meant to fund efforts to combat Seattle's homeless problem. The tax would have raised $47 million a year to fund affordable housing projects. We're joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She's the editor of liberationnews.org. Jane, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Thanks. It's good to be on the show.
Jane, Seattle's got a particularly bad problem with homelessness. And this was this tax was something very progressive that was going to help a lot of people. Now the money's gone. So how are homeless people going to be helped?
Basically, not very much at all. The way they're going to be, quote unquote, helped is by continuing police sweeps of their encampments if those encampments are not authorized, which means their belongings eventually will be rounded up and thrown away or stored. And the people will just have to go and find another place to live.
I was in Seattle recently, and I was surprised at the number of encampments. They're everywhere. And I know that rents have gotten so high that even people who are working full-time jobs are sometimes placed out of the housing market. It's just too expensive.
That's absolutely correct. There's a number of factors that are driving it. One is rent control is illegal in the state of Washington, and we also have one of arguably the most regressive tax system in the country. We do not have a state income tax, so all services are funded through sales taxes, and of course other taxes like property tax, all regressive taxes. So the other factor that's really played a role in this has been the influx of technology companies into Seattle recently, which has brought in people with higher incomes. And based on a market system, the landlords want to chase those higher paid employees. And so they raise the rent to a level which would be acceptable to a higher paid worker who wants the convenience of living close to their workplace at Amazon downtown, but putting it out of the reach of the many countless workers who also work in the area, providing services to those Amazon employees, such as restaurant workers, retail workers, et cetera.
Let's talk about the sequence of events when it comes to this tax, because I think the last time that we had you on the show, we were talking about, you know, the success, you know, even if it was a limited success, that the Seattle City Council and the grassroots movement in Seattle had won by getting a version of this tax passed. But now it's been revoked. Why is that?
So immediately after the city council voted unanimously to pass a compromise measure that would raise $47 or $48 million on what's called an employee head tax. So in other words, companies that had more than $20 million in annual revenue would be charged a small amount per hour per worker every year, adding up to a small amount per worker on an annual basis. And that was passed unanimously and approved by the mayor, Jenny Durkin. What then happened was the companies started to collect signatures to put the measure on the ballot. That's always an option when city council passes a piece of legislation. Citizens can collect signatures and submit the law that was passed to the voters as an initiative or a referendum. So essentially the Chamber of Commerce, Amazon, other companies started hiring. They hired petition gatherers and they started collecting the signatures. When they announced, now as soon as that happened, the forces that had supported the measure began organizing a decline to sign campaign. However, within about 2 weeks, the anti-head tax forces announced that they had collected enough signatures to place it on the ballot. At that point, City Council called for, or members of City Council called for a meeting to be held within 24 hours to vote on repealing it altogether. And they basically said, we're not strong enough to fight these big businesses. We can't outspend them. where it looks like the voting populace is against this head tax. Of course, there's been nothing but a ridiculous propaganda against the head tax, saying it's a, quote, tax on jobs. Amazon, of course, with its attempt to bully and blackmail and threaten the city by temporarily shutting down construction on a building they're building. It's kind of this threat that they're going to, that all these companies are going to leave Seattle and take their jobs with them. And so that has affected the general public because there's not really been a fair and open discussion of the issue. There's also been a lot of anti-homeless hate agitation that's gone on where, you know, stop coddling the homeless and things like that, which expresses no understanding of what it's really like to be homeless. So the majority of the city council just folded in the face of this rather than standing up for what they know is right, for what they know is necessary, which is not $48 million, but $400 million is what's actually needed to solve the problem. And instead they folded. To their credit, two members did vote against the repeal. Those would be Shama Sawant, the socialist, and Teresa Mosqueda, who is a strongly labor-tied member of city council who was recently elected to her seat.
You know, I'm wondering, too, what kind of a precedent this sets. Here in the Washington area, Jeff Bezos is a major player. He's the owner of Amazon. He owns the Washington Post. He owns Amazon Cloud Services, which is out in Herndon, Virginia. And Washington, Northern Virginia, and suburban Maryland are three of the places being considered to host the new Amazon headquarters. Well, politicians are falling all over themselves to offer Amazon tax breaks. And I wonder if this win in Seattle is going to have the same effect here in the Washington area, and it's going to put more people that much farther away from a place to live.
It's very likely that that could happen. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball, but and of course, there's already a serious gentrification problem going on in the other, as we call it here, the other Washington, Washington, D.C. And there already was before Amazon started growing so very rapidly here in Seattle. But it definitely could drive further gentrification, further displacement of working class people out of their communities by raising the rents. Obviously, there could be other factors that could come into play, such as rent control. But Bezos, I mean, he's the richest man in the world right now. And he was basically saying the other day that he doesn't know what to do with his money, but he does know what to do with his money. He uses his money to defeat these measures that would cause Amazon to pay what is essentially chump change for them to address a problem that they helped create.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos is thought to be worth about $138 billion. That's
stunning.
His net worth. Yeah, I mean, like, imagine if you took just 1% of that wealth, which Bezos would, I mean, he wouldn't even notice that, right? But that's, you know, that's about $1.4 billion. Think about what society could do with that kind of money, let alone, you know, just one municipality like Seattle or Washington, D.C. I mean, think about just this massive accumulation of wealth. Why are they taking just this head tax in Seattle so seriously when they have so much, just unspeakable amounts of money?
I mean, obviously I can't read their minds, but I would assume it has to do with the precedent that it sets. They believe they have absolutely no responsibility, no accountability to the larger community, society as represented by local or state or federal government, really, that they feel that they are more powerful than our democracy, even, that they should be able to do whatever they want. And that is the supreme good in society, is for them to be able to do whatever they want in pursuit of profit. And so if Seattle takes, you know, a few million dollars from them every year, what's to stop the next city from taking a few million? And before you know it, it'll all be over for them. And that's the way they think. Of course, that's what we want, is we want it to be all over for them, because they're literally, I mean, here in Washington State, Amazon, people think of the Amazon workers as these rich tech employees or well-paid tech employees. But we also have the warehouses where those people who work in the warehouses, the fulfillment centers, they are on public assistance. They're receiving state health care and other state services because they're not making ends meet. they can't afford to live in Seattle. They live way out far, far in the distant reaches of the county, and they work in the warehouse doing backbreaking labor, and they can't afford to even have health care. They're not being provided with health care.
You know, this is actually one of the painful things about this tax repeal, too, is that it wasn't the workers paying this tax out of their paychecks. It was the companies paying it. And as Jane said a few minutes ago, it was just a, you know, a few cents per hour per employee from companies that make billions and billions of dollars. It's petty cash kind of amounts of money that would have helped the homeless. And it's just not going to happen. One interesting thing, too, was, as Jane said, the tax was passed unanimously. And it was repealed almost unanimously by a vote of 7-2. I was disappointed in that.
Yeah, I think we all were. These city council members were not willing, for the most part, to put up any kind of a fight. And that really says something about our democracy, that it's truly a dollar democracy. The ones who think they can pay the piper get to call the tune. And that's why we really need to fight for a society which represents the interests of the many and not the few. Jeff Bezos is one guy.
That's right. The fight's not over. We're out of time, though. We were joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. Jane is the editor of liberationnews.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
In a major defeat for the Justice Department, a federal judge yesterday approved AT&T's $85.4 billion merger with Time Warner. It's a decision that's expected to unleash a wave of corporate mergers, beginning with CVS and Aetna Insurance. We're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/prof Steve Keen. Steve, welcome back.
Good to be here, guys.
Steve, legalities of this merger aside, what does the consumer get out of this new super company where two companies are merged that don't appear to have anything really in common?
Well, this is the trouble. A lot of these mergers are basically financial engineering. And frequently, they talk about some synergy that can develop between two very different organizations. And in fact, what often happens is that there's a loss of skill set inside the company. The dominant firm sacks a lot of the, very comfortably terminates a lot of the employees of the other firm, and you actually lose efficiency. But what you gain is a financial behemoth, and that's what they're really after these days, rather than any industrial synergies.
You know, I remember when Time Warner, I remember when it was Time Magazine and Warner Communications, and then they merged. And then Time Warner merged with AOL. It became AOL Time Warner. Then they just absorbed AOL. Now it's Time Warner AT&T. Where does this end? I mean, we have monopoly laws in this country, anti-monopoly laws. And it just seems that with merger after merger now being deemed legal, we're getting these super companies that are so big and so powerful that they control pricing, they control competition, and that it's the consumer that loses at the end of the day.
Well, it's actually a bit more complex than that, because sometimes the consumer wins. I mean, I'm not going to defend Amazon's warehousing labor management rules or their pay rates, obviously. But what you get out of Amazon is a behemoth, which is actually directed at one particular thing. That's taking over the retail industry. And it's an intriguing factor that, in fact, it's been quite successful at that. Now, the reason that this ends up being possible is that you get enormous economies of scale out of a company of that scale, and it can undercut anybody else's operations. And what you effectively get is a command economy working inside the market economy. And this is the part that conventional economics doesn't get its head around, and that's one reason why it ends up ultimately being so easy to sidestep them in court challenges. Because their theory says, well, if you have monopolies, there'll be higher prices and lower quantities. In fact, what tends to happen with things like Amazon is lower prices and higher quantities. So the consumer ends up winning, and you have a real conflict between the two. But at the same time, a lot of the mergers that are occurring are these sort of financial combinations rather than ones that extend an industrial practice that's very successful from one country to another. And they are really about driving out competition. And I've personally seen this, by the way, when for a short while I was being paid by a small firm in Australian media market. and they were taken over by Rupert Murdoch. And of course, after a short while, everything in them except the name was shut down. It was basically buying out the competition rather than actually extending a better service to the public.
Steve, what are the role of the big banks? What is the role of the big banks in mergers and acquisitions like this one? This is between AT&T and Time Warner, an $85 billion deal. I mean, a percentage of that is going to go to a bank, right? Or maybe several banks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is what the banks salivate over, this sort of stuff, because that's how they make major fees. And you'll often get I don't know what the scale would be, but I wouldn't be amazed to find it's a 1 or 2% success fee for getting the merger through. So you're talking something a couple of $1 billion out of that, which is very, very healthy profits for the bank. And of course, it goes into the pockets of the major company executives in the bank more so than it goes to the employees working down at what used to be the teller. So they salivate over it. And this is, again, it's financial engineering. It's not anything which is going to produce a beneficial improvement in the delivery of telecommunications.
What do you think this says about where the economy is in terms of, you know, what's referred to in mainstream business press as the business cycle? You know, generally, there is a recession every 10 years or so. It's been about 10 years since there is the last recession. And even though these big economic deals are going through and in some areas of the economy, growth is quite strong, there are also people out there who are saying that, you know, this is actually a sign that the economy is, quote unquote, overheated, or that the banks, that there's, you know, a great amount of money out there, there's a great amount of capital to be invested, but because the underlying economy is weak, we see a surge of this type of more speculative or purely financial activity before there is an economic downturn.
Yeah, we don't see any particular investment taking place, and this is the great weakness of this current market, because courtesy of QE, fundamentally, the share price is being pumped up so much.
That's quantitative easing.
Thank you. The pumping up of shares has been so great that all these companies with, you know, massively overvalued shares courtesy of QE now have huge buying power. And in some ways, that's what's being exploited here. It's not in investment taking place. At the same time, I think that given the level of the stimulus that the Trump government is pumping into the economy courtesy of its tax cuts and some parts of its spending, there is a boom actually taking place now, which is actually the first real one in the last decade. So for a decade, the economy has been on life support courtesy of quantitative easing, very expensive life support that actually benefits the wealthy rather than the poor, but nonetheless life support. And now that that's coming to an end, and they're trying to unwind QE, at the same time, you have Trump's level of deficit spending causing a genuine boom in the economy. And what I expect to have happen is a continuation of this boom for a couple of years and then a very large spike in wages, because at the moment, the reason there's been a boom without a return to wages is that workers no longer have any bargaining power. The union bargaining power has been destroyed. So they'll come into this game at a very late stage when employers rather start putting up wages simply to grab staff.